This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. This is part two of my conversation with acclaimed Melbourne writer Christos Tsolkas. If you haven't had a listen yet to part one, I do encourage you to go back to hear Christos's genesis story as an artist and writer, his first experiences of publishing, dealing with failure, and learning about the industry. In this, the second part of our conversation, we discuss success, paying attention to happy accidents in the writing process, what he wanted to say about doubt, certainty, beauty, and the contemporary novel in his latest book, 7.5, his advice on being a good industry citizen, and the writing advice he holds most dear. Do be advised, if you're listening on speaker, that there is some colourful language towards the end of this episode. Enjoy. Christos, let's go from failure to success, because the other thing that listeners will know, my most quoted piece of advice or anecdote, is you speaking to Charlotte Wood in her wonderful series of interviews, The Writer's Room, about the experience of the success of The Slap. And I'm going to quote it because I always kind of misquote it, I'm sure. So I found it. And you say, man, I was not prepared for the level of self-doubt that can come from success. I wasn't prepared for the greed that can come from success, the greed for more of it. And I remember reading that the first time. I would have read it the first time before I was even published the first time, and thinking, wow, what is this thing? What's he even talking about? And then being very aware of moments since then where I've gone, oh yeah, this expectation that once there is even a small element of success, that you just want more and more and more, feed the beast. How did you deal with that?
Oh, well, partly, so the first moment since Loaded, and even before that, because I've been writing before Loaded, it's the first moment where I actually am so stunned by what's happened that I don't have an idea for a book. Like I don't know what to write. Look, saying all that, there's also an immense kind of gratitude I feel for the success it's made. You know, it for the first time in our lives, because Wayne and I share a life together, it's like, oh my God, we don't have to worry about the rent. You know, we can actually, you know, we get the mortgage now. I have not ever known what this means. And so there's that. And there's also, and I'm really grateful for this too, that my father, before he passed away, was able to see the success. Because, you know, he the world he came from, he and mum were so encouraging of me writing, but they were terrified about it. You know, and they just were like, he's never going to make any money, right? He's going to, you know, it's a tough life. And I think it was a quiet relief that he had. And also because it was published in Greek, and the other works were as well, but you know, he was such a sweet man. He said, oh Christos, I started the Greek edition of Loaded, he said, but after a page I went, there's no point in me reading this.
Not for me.
Mum, God bless her, she did read it. He did, and he's a very slow reader because, you know, but he read The Slap in Greek, and he said to me, and it's one of the most important moments of my life. He said, I really like the set with Manolis, who's the old Greek character in that. And I just, you know, that feels like when the demons of self-doubt come on me, I just think of that moment, and, you know, that's like him, his ghost is there looking after me. that scrutiny that comes with success, that's the hardest thing I had to work out. I'd every single book I had done before that was the book I wanted to do. Mm. I mean, I'm quite selfish in that way. Mm. I mean, you're thinking of the reader abstractly when you're editing or when you are redrafting, of course, because you're thinking, but actually it's like, it's an abstract reader. Mm. Like the best reader is for me is this idealized reader, which is, you know, but the book I'm writing is for myself. Every book I've written is the book I've wanted to write for myself. You know, it sounds pejorative, but I don't mean it in that sense. I think that is the selfishness of the artist, right? That's what we do. That's part of what we do. That's why I lock myself in this study that I'm talking to you from and just do my work, and I can shut out the world. Mm. You know, I've chosen this as my vocation because I love it so much, and I couldn't shut out the world for a period after the slap. I'm just trying to work out, oh my God, what's happened to our lives?
Yeah.
And what does this mean? How do I write? And how do I not write the slap to?
Mm.
And how do I not write something so kind of ultra or deranged in response to it not being the slap to, yes, right?
Yes. So, which is the instinct, right?
Yeah.
Push away.
Yeah. I'm just going to write, you know, some really obscure experimental work that is just full of cocks coming for page after page, right? And then I had time with Wayne, and I thought about all this, and I went to the South Coast, and I went to Scotland, and that was one of the most wonderful experiences of my writing life. I got a three-month residency in a place called Cove on the west coast of Scotland, at a place, Cove Park. I'd already begun to think of Barracuda, the next novel, and it was thinking through what was happening in my life, and I just went, actually, I'm going to write, I wonder if I can write about success and failure. And I knew I didn't want to write about a writer dealing with success and failure. Like, I just thought that's not interesting for me. I don't think and that's the most important, it just wasn't interesting for me. But I thought about a sports person, and even as I'm telling you all this now, I realize what happened was from just that germ of going, maybe I'll write about success and failure. I'm not going to make it about a writer. Maybe I'm going to make it about a sports person. Suddenly I stopped thinking about the slap. I started thinking about the next book, and that was really important. There's a lot I could say about the stories that, you know, what was happening in the swimming world and Barracuda, but the most important thing to say about it was that it came out of that confusing period, and then it was the finding of kind of, so again, let's say a thread that I started to follow, and I suddenly was out of the forest. And that moment is really important, I think. That was the moment I realised, yes, that's how you do it, is you just start the next book. Mm, mm. You know, and that would be my only advice to people, from the greatest success to a failure, whatever that failure might mean to you, just start the next book. Mm. I know that's easy to say, but I do think there's only one way of putting all of that behind and finding the right place for it to rest is by doing the work, going back to the work again.
Mm. I'm going to jump forward because of something you said then too about the combination of things that happened that led you to being able to start Barracuda. And in your latest book, in 7.5, there's this line, the wondrous alchemy that is synchrony being the one essential condition of all artists, regardless of their craft. And also this other line after the character, let's say, Christos, is experiencing watching two films back to back, and says, I am a writer and I believe in the utility of accident, its necessity. And I wanted to ask you about how you pay attention to, or how you stay open to, synchrony and the utility of accident. in your writing practice?
Oh, this is the ideal. I don't always live up to it, but from the get-go, from a very young person starting to writing, I said, I'm going to try and write 1,500 words a day, and that's going to be my, I'm going to walk to work, or, you know, a combination of walking and public transport, whatever the, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've got a studio of my own, which is a half an hour walk from home that I use, but I used to rent a shared studio space in Brunswick for years, and I love that as well. But I love the idea of going to work. And to your question, that's part of where the, you know, because every day is different, and you change routes, but even if you find the same route, something is going to emerge in your vision, in what you hear, in a conversation in a tram, it's that may find its way into what you're doing. It may not, you know, but that's how you do it. But if for someone like myself, if I didn't have that framework of discipline that I've created, I would lose that. I just wouldn't know how to put it, you know, it would go. I always carry, it's in my bag. Sorry, I know it's an audio medium, but I'm showing it to you. This is a journal. Like, look, I always have it in my bag. So it's always there for notes. It's just being, I think it's walking that fine line between discipline and what I'm trying to think of the right word. It's not recklessness. It is accident, actually. It is accident. It's just that you can't predict, I think, what your story is going to be until the process of actually writing it. You can't predict what your character is going to say until the process of writing it. And what I find, and you find this, right? I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning because suddenly in my head, the book I'm working on at the moment, I think this is the conversation they're going to have, right? This is how she's going to say that, he's going to say that, she's going to respond that way, he's going to respond that. I may even make the notation. Fine, I'll go into work next morning and I'm going to write it. And the people at the bakery have just been having an argument, and I sit down and suddenly she's saying something completely different, and she's using an expression that Ms. Nguyen used, but he's saying something that's completely different to what I thought he was going to say, and I don't know where the hell that came from. The actual work that goes on the page would not have been possible without thinking that happened at 3 a.m. and without the happy accident of what happened on the way to work. Mm.
Does this include, I know that you've mentioned a couple of times, the Doris Lessing concept of fugging time.
Yeah.
Is this part of this as well?
This is, yeah. I think being in thought and being in imagination is what we are incredibly lucky to be able to do. And again, this is the ideal. I berate myself all the time for not doing this often enough, is to just to have the phone nowhere near me, to shut off the computer, to actually sit down or take a walk and allow the sensations of the world to be, to come to you, to experience things, and fugging time for me. And Patricia Cornelius introduced me to Lessing's use of this term, is exactly that, is to be in the world and in imagination at the same time, to be able to do that. And so for me, the thrill of, you know, my interpretation of fugging time, of Lessing's notion is, and that's when it's thrilling, is when you are both, you're there, the world is coming in, you're thinking about what is the sensation of your finger touching a pen or touching the cup of coffee, but you're also lost. You know, you're lost in the world. You've actually stepped in the world that you're trying to create. You know, it's that in 7.5, why it remains. And I talk about it, how, you know, one of the pivotal screen experiences. You know, just that shiver. Is it a shiver? It's a shock that a great work that you know is going to be with you through the rest of the life happens. Mm. And it was watching Jean Cocteau's Orpheus, and the moment he goes through the mirror. Mm. You know, so I think, you know, most of the time at work, it's like putting your hands on that glass and it just the bang. And then there's those moments when suddenly your hand slips through and you're in the other world. Mm. Underworld, other world, call it what you like. And I don't think that's possible without that fucking time, without that patience, without that breathing. I don't think it's an accident that after the slap, Barracuda, Danny's a swimmer. Mm. Because that book is all about breathing. Mm. You know, how do you breathe when you swim? How do you breathe when you're in the world? How do you breathe again after tragedy?
The other thing that really struck me and that is repeated throughout Seven and a Half is this idea about abandoning belief in certainty and about being in doubt, which kind of when you were just speaking then about that in-between space, you know, there's a real resonance there too. You say in an article, in an interview with Bridget Delaney in The Guardian, which I'll link to, you said, at writers' festivals over the past few years, I felt as if I was disappointing people if I was expressing doubt or nuance, and I felt a certain pressure to articulate certain positions in politics that I didn't yet know what I felt about. And I wanted to ask you about abandoning this kind of belief in certainty that either for you or as expressed in Seven and a Half.
You know, I think, God, it's taken me a long time to trust my instincts, Kate, when it comes to this, right? So I don't think I could have written Seven and a Half without the experience of writing Damascus before that, which is, so for listeners, Damascus, which took me a long time and is probably the pleasure of immersing myself in that book is just thinking about it makes me really happy, right? So it's a book about the early days of Christianity before it's even got a name. It's about Paul, Saul of Tarsus, who becomes Paul. I just immerse myself in the questions of faith and the spirit and the soul and history, and it was the best study I've ever done. You know, it was real study. I just loved being in philosophy. I loved being in theology. I loved being in history. I loved being in that. The challenge of can you imagine 2,000 years ago, and actually can you put that in words? Like that was revelatory, that whole experience. But it also reminded me, I did have a faith in God when I was very young. And in fact, I became evangelical. My heritage faith is Orthodox Christianity, Greek Orthodox Christianity. I became evangelical in that bargaining with God period with my sexuality, you know, because I thought the devil had me. You know, that's unfortunately how strong those fears can be. And then I thought, I don't believe you. I don't believe in this anymore. And I stopped believing in God, but then almost immediately I replaced it with something called Marxism. you know, and I think why I'm saying that is I think the instinct of doubt back there at 15, 16 was right, but I didn't know how to live in doubt. And I thought I needed to have a coherent set of ideas and ideologies or beliefs to survive in the world. And maybe I did, actually, Kate. I don't, you know, by the time I've come to Damascus, I'm an older person, and I also recognize something that was consoling, I think, in religious faith, and that's prayer, like kind of like and that I don't need to be afraid of it. I don't have to. I read this amazing quote the other. Sorry, just yesterday, and I have to tell you. And he's a Colombian writer called Nicolas Gomez Davila, who is you know, he's quite right wing, but sometimes the devil has the best tunes, right? And he wrote, he was quite a spiritual writer, and he said, and one of his aphorisms is that perhaps, I hope I'm quoting it close to the Spanish, perhaps I am not a Christian, perhaps I am a pagan who believes in Christ. And I think that I just, why it's, I think that's what I learned in Damascus. I think that's what I am. That's exactly what I am, actually. That's why I just jumped at it when I read it yesterday. To your question, no, sorry, I'm running around.
I love it.
Just thinking through the questions of belief and faith and realizing, and Jane was, Paul Freeman was instrumental here, because the first draft of Damascus was a mess. And she said, you haven't dealt with doubt. And that was like, you know, that was like, oh, God, you're right. Go back to the drawing board and start again. You know, that was very, you know, that's what a great editor does, right? Yeah. They can see that. They can see what's not there. Anyway, and I really, I dealt with doubt in the story. I dealt with doubt in myself. And I think doubt is... I'm grateful for doubt, okay? And it feels like, and partly, as I said, 7.5 is not possible about the Damascus. Mm. It just feels like this is not a world or a time of where doubt is given any space or acknowledgement or respect. I can, that doesn't mean you can't argue with doubt. There are things that are not possible if you live only in doubt. I know that. But I think doubt is, so important, and I'm fearful of people who don't have doubt. Mm. I'm fearful whether they're evangelical Christians or whether they're fundamentalist of Muslims or whether they're ideologues of any stripe. Because I think without doubt, the questions cannot come if there is no doubt, right? So, and I think. To live in a world without questions is just poisonous for what we do as writers, right?
Christo in the novel says he wants to write about beauty, that he's tired of outrage and anger. And you know, there's this incredible scene, which I know you must have to talk about all the time, where he's speaking to his friend Andrea, and she's apoplectic about his statement that he wants to write a book of about beauty. And she says he can't. And the exchange is very thrilling. And at various times I was convinced by both characters and repelled by both, which, you know, I'm not sure. I assume that's part of what you wanted to do. At one point, the character of Christos, then Christo, goes on to say, how more tedious can the contemporary novel become? You know, and goes on, I go into a bookshop these days and as if the shelves are filled with the agonised and narcissistic rantings of teenagers. Now, I can imagine, and I know from reading some of the reviews, that this has raised the hackles of some people. What gives you the shits about the contemporary novel these days? Can you tell me that? And we can take it in or take it out.
All right. Now, one thing I need to say about that scene, that chapter, the you know, people are going, who is she? Who's Andrea? Is it so-and-so? And it's like, no, it's me. Right? So this is what we're all going through at the moment, right? That 7.5 is a book about what it means to write. And what you do in the moment is sometimes I'm Andrea going, what's the point of me? Another, you know, male writing anything, you know, if I can just step off the stage, right?
Yeah.
And then there's that part of me that goes, fuck, this is what I do. I don't know how many more years I've got on this planet. I'm going to live it by doing the thing I love. So fuck you, you know, if you can. So to understand that chapter for me is about understanding that this is we're all asking these questions. And so the question of doubt, right, is it's in the space between there, right?
Yeah.
Having said that, what to take on the voice of Christo, like to where he's coming from in the book, is I get told that people want to write revolutionary stuff. They want to write radical stuff. They want to burn the world. They want to be that the writing is about. It's talking back to the man, you know, whether you define the man as cis or white or black, whatever, you know the language I'm talking yeah. about. And then it's the most timid writing. Everyone I speak to seems to be terrified of what someone's going to say about them on Twitter. So they will not risk an opinion that is new, challenging, but even more vilely, and this is vile, they will not defend a friend mm-hmm. against attacked because they're scared of the damage that will come their way, or they want it. They talk this language of the radical, and then they're asking me, "How do I get a New York agent? How do I, you know, how? What do you think if I advertise this brand on my feed?" And it's like, "Fuck off!" You know, I don't call myself a radical because that's a big word, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's a really big word. It's a big word whether you're talking about it as activism or whether you're talking about it as writing.
Yes.
You know, and so don't tell me, you know, don't that somehow, you know, you don't want to do dangerous stuff. You don't want to do risky stuff. You're always looking over your shoulder. You're wondering what people are going to think of you. I get that. I get that. We all have that thing, but you have to take risks and you have to, put yourself on the line sometime. And it's that timidity. I cannot tell you, Kate, and this is only in Australia, this is everywhere, how many writers, you know, in the green room will whisper, "I can't say that, I don't want to say that," you know, and then they go out and they tell the audience exactly what they think the audience wants to hear. And this is a generalisation. There's a lot of gutless people out there at the moment. And that's where Christo's anger is coming from. Andrea's is coming from the other argument, which is to say, yeah, you say that because you are a white male now. You didn't used to be, but now you are, who's able to, you know, you've had success and you've had money. So you can take risks that I can't because I've been born in a world, in a colour, in a body, in a situation where it's a struggle every day of my life. So, yes. Andrea and Christo are arguing, and they will be arguing for a long time.
I want to move to reading because what I did sit here and devour just yesterday is you writing on Patrick White in the series, Writers on Writers. You say at one point, reading a great writer is a challenge because it always makes you want to better yourself. And then there's this beautiful part, page 32 for people who have a copy, but I want to quote it if you don't mind. You go on to say that reading a great work, a perfect novel, which we discussed before, in this case you're talking about Patrick White's The Tree of Man, does not incapacitate a writer. Rather, you say, you are humbled and your return to the desk is tempered by this understanding. You are grateful for the opportunity that life and circumstances have given you to engage in your labour. You are careful from then on to fight against turpitude and to accept but also confront your own limitations. And I love this and I feel this deeply. And I wanted just to ask you to tell us a bit more about how great novels propel your writing in that moment, or about White, if you would like to.
Oh, I mean, I think, you know, the experience of reading White, it just told me something about patience again, right? You know, I encountered White when I was very young and I didn't have the patience or the skills or the, you know, to appreciate him. That not completely true. I did respond to the Tyburn affair at the time, but it took me a long apprenticeship to get to White. But that experience of reading him that year and writing about it for that monograph was just, it was a reminder, Kate, so we're going right back to the beginning of this interview about what happened. I fell in love with something called writing, you know, and it was, you know, there is, even in that moment where I'm talking to you about the Heart is a Lonely Hunter, right? Yes, there's a stirring of something there of, I want to do this, but there's not a sense of, at that moment, when you encounter a great novel, Tree of Man is a great novel. Heart is a Lonely Hunter is a great novel. It doesn't have to be perfect. Devils, Brothers Karamazov, are great novels. They're not perfect, but they're fucking great novels. They're at that moment of encountering, of being in the novel, of seeing what this writer can do with words, what this writer can do with ideas, what this writer is making you experience, making you feel, making you think. There is no sense of competition. You're just thrilled. You're just in the ecstasy of going, I love this. I love this experience. How fortunate I am that I can be part of this experience. Mm. You know, and in that moment, and the moment when you shut Tree of Man, you want to fly to your desk and do something, not because you're in competition, Patrick White, because you know you're never going to write that. It's just like, oh my God, this is the gift of what this is, this thing called writing, you know. And the only, you know, that's why I think writing is, why books are so important, right? Why the great films are so important is that I think that and why it saves your life is that it's when you have that experience, it makes you realize you can do it, or I can have that experience again, or both.
We talked about Ange Savage and what an incredible industry citizen, good industry citizen she is. And I'm thinking about you as patron of Writers Victoria, about mentorships, about endorsing novels, about all the appearances you do, interviews like this, also frequently described as a giver of the best hugs in the industry, generous. I wanted to ask about the role, or perhaps responsibility, you see as being a good citizen of the literary community or the arts community more broadly at this time, and how you go about doing that, or how we could go about doing that better too.
I mean, I do think there is, you know, we've talked, Kate, about how important the mentoring process has been for me. The so yes, I think to always, to just that, take that time with someone who comes up to you, and just take that time, you know, and really listen, because that's me at 19, or that's you at 19, right? That's the person. I think the you know, something like Writers Victoria for me, the support there is because I know the work they're doing, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm also thinking of those people who don't have, in their families or in their backgrounds, a world where they understand how writing happens, how the industry works, what are some of those terms that we've been using today.
Yeah.
And I would encourage people to go to their state writing centres, because that's what they're there for, is to begin to give you that knowledge, right? And that was invaluable for me. So I'm really proud to do that, to be a patron of that centre. Education, you know, I just wish we had more money going into education, you know, because I think it's clear, you listen to this, and I'm not the only one, you know, lots of the writers you talk to, I know, those teachers, those experiences of finding that person who went, I get you, are pivotal in leading you to becoming a writer. But, you know, my friend, really simplest advice would be, or simplest thing is, you know, what my niece says, don't be a dick. Actually, don't be, you know, just be human to the whole world around you. And the whole world is not just your fellow writers in the literary world. It's the people who volunteer at the festivals. It's the people who work in the offices at the publishers. It's the people who are doing the sound checks at the festival venues or where you're talking. You know, just and not like, you know, it's not being a friend of all the world in that way. It's just kind of just being considerate. I think I just would like more of that. I wish we went.
It's brilliant advice. We finish always with advice, and I tell you, I couldn't, you know, I already have all these dot points of all the brilliant advice you've given today, including don't be a dick. But
thank my niece for that.
Is there a piece, and I'm thinking back to, you know, your early mentor in Sasha, or other advice that you've been given about the writing life or the writing process along the way that is the piece that you return to again and again that you want to pass on to the people listening today?
Actually, because it does, I do, you know, I do often quote it, is a piece of Sasha's advice, and it had to do with, you know, those wounded feelings that came from a negative review. It wasn't even a particularly bad review, really. It was just, I just thought, oh, they didn't get it, they didn't get it. And Sasha went, Christos, you can't look over every reader's shoulder going, no, no, that's not what I meant. You know, you have to, there is a point with the book, you have to give it up. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. I think that's what the advice is. And that's tough to learn, to actually go, and I think Sasha's absolutely right. You know, the reader is going to, their experience of that book is going to be their experience, and you can't control that. And so that's an advice I think is worth passing on.
It's wonderful. We all need a reminder of that. And finally, dear Christos, we always ask, have you got a first book, a debut book, any genre, any time, that you would like to recommend to our listeners?
Oh, look, because I loved Jesse Tu's A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing. I really did. That was one of those books a couple of years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But just, you know, what you're hungry for is to hear a voice that you haven't heard before. And Tu's book, I heard a voice I hadn't heard before. So I'm going to leave you with that one because, you know, I adore that book.
That's perfect. And I spoke to Jessie actually. So I'll link to that interview too, and people can hear her speak about that wonderful book. Christos, it has been an absolute joy. I've written so many notes down here next to me. Thank you.
And thank you for being so patient, my friend. I really appreciate it.
That was just so brilliant. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.